You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 10th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, and for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Travis Lupik, author of Light Up the Night, America's Overdose Crisis and the Drug Users Fighting for Survival. Meanwhile, as the world surpasses 400 million known COVID cases, many governors in blue states are announcing mask mandate rollbacks, so they're politicians, what can you say? Build back forgetter? All right. Senate Democrats are publicly for the first... No need to force it, Matt. Senate Democrats are publicly for the first time acknowledging that Biden's entire social spending agenda could be dead. Speaking to Politico about it. Although Schumer maintains that he has some tricks up his sleeve, but maybe he means the cereal. Now that Pelosi has been publicly pressured into signing on to the ban on members of Congress trading stocks, it's becoming a bit more real, so that means the backlash is becoming a bit more real. Representatives Cindy Axne of Iowa and Elaine Luria of Virginia are leading the charge against this legislation. How brave. Congress is proposing $500 million to fund anti-China news coverage in U.S.-run foreign media, which seems a lot more transparent in its dishonest intentions than I'm used to, honestly. The Florida Senate Education Committee just passed the so-called Don't Say Gay bill. It has to go to the legislature in general, but DeSantis is behind it. The bill would ban classroom discussion of sexual orientation and gender identity. So, kids don't ask, teachers don't tell.
Is that a downgrade from, yeah, don't ask, don't tell?
I mean, they're like ripping it off and just putting it in schools,
don't
essentially.
Say.
Yeah.
Don't speak.
Thank you, Gwen Stefani. And lastly, anti-vax protesters in Canada have now blocked a third border crossing point with the U.S., and copycat protests are growing internationally. More on that in a second. All this and more on today's program. What a time to be getting a call just then. How is everybody doing? A bit of a chaotic opening, but, you know, that's how we do things here. I think we have a great show ahead. We are first going to be speaking, as I mentioned, to Travis Lupik, author of Light Up the Night, America's Overdose Crisis and the Drug Users Fighting for Survival, which will be a great discussion, especially in the wake of, I saw Biden's crack pipes or something to that effect was trending on Twitter.
Oh my God.
Yep. So that's a thing. So another timely interview here. And after that, we will be speaking with, I should have headlined this, Jessica Cisneros. Jessica Cisneros, who is running in a very tight primary election for the second time against Henry Cuellar. Bad guy. One of the most conservative Democrats in Congress, who is currently being investigated by the FBI. So that says a lot about him. She has run before. She was a still is a Justice Democrat, I believe. Very progressive. Great candidate, and I'm looking forward to speaking to her a little bit later in the program.
Yeah, and the FBI investigation may be ongoing, but my investigation is concluded, and Cuellar sucks, and
yeah,
he should be removed from office.
Yep. So, with that said, let's actually dive into the trucker situation in Canada, because I don't think we've talked that much about it, mostly because it's stupid. But I think it's instructive to dive a little bit deeper into these right-wing protests here in Canada. So in Canada, there's a group of people calling themselves the Freedom Convoy. It's truckers mostly, but sympathizers as well. They're essentially anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, And they're cloaking themselves in this aura of workers' rights, this aesthetic of fighting for the everyday person. But they aren't fighting for higher wages for all. They're not working to get more bargaining power for other truckers, more benefits.
Or safety. They're actually fighting against that.
Yeah, right. Against worker safety, but yet they are for workers' rights. So they're basically just upset about COVID protocols. There are other truckers in the United States who are actually fighting for material benefits for all. They aren't getting 1% of the media coverage. Right now, conservative media in the United States is heralding these Canadian truckers as these benevolent heroes. But right now, here, I'm interested if someone like Tucker Carlson or Laura Ingraham wants to pick up on the story. Maybe they haven't seen it. Bradley, if you could pull this up. XPO port truckers in the West Coast of the United States, they are currently fighting to unionize. And yet, that hundreds of Southern California port truckers have launched a unionization bid to fight their increasingly brutal working conditions. When there's a discussion about workers' rights and how truckers are so important for our supply chains and for the maintenance of capitalism, especially when that's discussed on the right, working conditions, union efforts, that's not a part of the conversation, no. It's all about truckers and their individual right to not get vaccinated.
This is an anti-union, basically a right-to-work convoy. And it's a right-to-work instead of the typical like right-to-work without a union. It's the right-to-work without safety concerns. Like another one that's mentioned, this was October 13th in Toledo, Ohio. 30 workers walking the picket line at a Stericycle medical waste disposal plant. We heard from a caller last night on Left Reckoning that there are maybe more Stericycle actions going on for the truckers for that company. So, yeah, it's what is emphasized, and is it pro boss? And these are very simple questions, and there shouldn't be no confusion. Like, we shouldn't even need like the fact that in their chats they're talking about like Hitler and yeah. That sort of like far right stuff, right? Like, this is a right to work convoy. It's a pro boss convoy. It's a get back to the status quo.
It's a bootlicker convoy.
Yeah, it's a get back to the status quo of capitalism, and that's why its biggest cheerleaders here are capitalists.
Right. And we'll get to their far right views in a second. But I think the fact that this story continues to grow, there are more freedom convoys sprouting in other border crossings in Canada. The main one that they're disrupting is the border between Detroit and Ottawa. Automakers have been affected. There were at least 2 Ford plants that had to shut down because these parts are not getting there. And I think some other auto manufacturers are considering doing the same. Businesses in the area have been affected, let alone the people that live by these border crossing areas and in these cities hearing the blaring horns of these far-right protesters. It's pissing them off. But the bottom line is, as Matt and I have already laid out, this is not about workers' rights. This is about far-right whining. 80% of Canada is vaccinated. I believe over 90% of truckers in Canada are vaccinated because to cross the border and to come back into Canada, you need to be vaccinated. So these people are a fringe. There have been reports of assaults perpetrated by the group.
I haven't looked into this, but like video of like a attack on an apartment complex, it looked kind of troubling. Like, and yeah, I it shouldn't be a difficult call on this one, frankly.
Well, let's let one of the leaders of this convoy make that call for us a little bit less difficult. This is Pat King. Here he is in 2019. Just making clear where his political perspective lies. And let's also be clear, as Matt pointed out in the chats of this convoy, this is not a fringe position in terms of where the politics of this group in general are at.
Now, what it is the part of the depopulation. And a lot of people don't understand what that means. And what there is there's an end game. It's called depopulation of the Caucasian race or the Anglo-Saxon. And that's what the goal is to depopulate the Anglo-Saxon race. Because they are the ones with the strongest bloodlines. And we'll leave it at that, because then we get into a whole different topic. But it's a depopulation of race. Okay, that's what they want to do. I've spoken before about how we have Ahmed Ahmadinejad, or Mahmed. I can't say their names very well because I don't have the dialect that they do. But
do you think we got the gist? Do you think we got the gist about this guy? Just in case, let me quickly read, though, too, from the New York Times about this guy. Pat King, who is listed as an official contact for a regional group involved in the protests and has been the prominent champion of the protests online, has called COVID a, quote, man-made bioweapon, and claimed that international financiers, I wonder what religion those financiers are, seek to, quote, depopulate the Anglo-Saxon race. He has said of lockdowns, the only way that this is going to be solved is with bullets. And the New York Times also says this influence and the inspiration and financial aid from some within the American far right is hardly hidden at the protests. Pro-Trump and QAnon signs are frequently visible, as are figures like Ramanda Diludu, a Canadian QAnon activist, Canadian QAnon activist who has called for military executions of doctors who vaccinate children.
We have another video posted by Q Anthony Omin on Twitter, originally from a Nephrite 1312. But do you have this? This is from their Zello chats, Bradley. If we can just put that up.
I'm seeing this cold.
Yeah, well, yeah, be prepared, because this is, you know.
Really interesting fact, since we were talking about the Nazis were actually fighting Antifa a lot. I don't know if anybody in here has actually ever translated it. And again, I'm not saying the dude was right at all. I'm simply saying
the dude is.
If you look at what he actually said, because since I've been on Telegram, I've met people from Germany, and they've translated the videos.
That's probably enough, Bradley. We can
probably of Hitler's speeches.
Yeah. So that's
the
political education that's going on in, and I think Q Anthony's point about like all of the people posing as leftists saying that we should take this at face value and this is actually the revolution. Okay, go organize them into your communist party.
Like,
let's see how hospitable and how open these people are to, like, you know, challenging capitalism as communists.
Right. I mean, and or how much people who honestly are that naive would be willing to compromise in order to let these people cosplaying as pro-worker advocates into their fold. That's the trade-off here. And so pretending like these people are on our side or this is legitimate in any way, it's a detriment. Just because they cloak themselves in the aesthetic of workers' rights does not mean they are representing workers. And that's borne out in the numbers in Canada for sure.
Yeah, it's laundering, whether you want to call it fascism or just pro-boss propaganda. It's what it is.
Yep. If you thought the Bundys were actually fighting government tyranny, I would think that you might also be the kind of person who's sympathetic to this convoy. And that means that you're an idiot. And you don't actually understand what it means to win on the left. With that said, do we have any ads today?
Oh, I know.
We do not. All right, might as well just bring them in. Do we have Travis? He's coming in. Travis Lupik. Here he is. Travis Lupik, award-winning journalist who's done work for outlets like the LA Times, Vice, author of Light Up the Night, America's Overdose Crisis, and the Drug Users Fighting for Survival. Travis, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm looking forward to our conversation because it's a very timely appearance for you.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, it is.
Yes. I mean, not to laugh at it, but really because this morning, something like Biden crack pipes was trending on Twitter. Because for people that aren't aware, the Biden administration announced essentially a trial, but very small grant program for harm reduction facilities and processes around the country. These kinds of policies have been the focus of your work, including your book before this one. So, and you've seen this on the front lines. What's your response to the uproar from certain political corners in the United States to about things like safe injection sites?
Yeah, I mean, this is a fantastic program, and the by far the largest, almost the very first vote of confidence we've seen in favor of harm reduction coming from America's federal government ever. This is the first time the White House has really come up publicly in favor of harm reduction in such a big way. And what that means is they're putting money behind things like needle exchange. A lot of it is education materials. A small part of it is money for quote unquote crack pipes. And that's a great word to put into headlines, and that's what we're seeing across the country. The distribution of crack pipes is actually something I've written about in the past. It's a good thing. When people share crack pipes, they can spread diseases like hepatitis C. So by distributing clean crack pipes, you know, we're preventing disease, and that saves everybody money and improves people's health. I get that it's a catchy word to put in the headlines, but it's actually a small piece of what's going on, and what is going on is actually something really positive that's going to save lives in this overdose crisis.
Well, there's no, and correct me if I'm wrong, evidence that the existence of crack pipes is going to increase the usage of crack. I mean, there are other ways to smoke crack as opposed to outside of, like, cleaner, better pipes. I've seen crack pipes before. I have not smoked crack. It doesn't create a more of a demand. It's just there are people that are uncomfortable with the fact that the government is even touching the subject. They'd rather addicts not be in their field of vision and just go away.
Sure. I mean, which I understand. If you have a moral or an ideological or a whatever objection to crack pipes, fine. But you cannot base your objection to harm reduction supplies on the evidence. Like you said, there actually is no evidence that distributing clean needles, crack pipes, etc., encourages drug use. And there actually is evidence that shows that it does not. I mean, harm reduction is something with 30 years of data behind it. You know, this is a favorite field of health researchers. There is a small mountain of academic papers that show that not only does needle exchange, crack pipe distribution, etc., reduce disease, but there is evidence, the stats show, it does not encourage drug use.
Right. Matt, our producer, writes in harm reduction doesn't care about your feelings, and that is the reality, right? I mean, it's more about looking away from the data, and we've seen this in the pandemic too, and just making something that makes me uncomfortable or makes me upset go away, and that's not a real adult way to run a society. And so that's the policies of harm reduction.
It's not an adult way to deal with this. I forgot to mention one of my favorite pieces of data or academic information. We actually have research that shows that engagement with harm reduction supplies, needle exchange, crack pipes, actually encourages treatment. It sounds counterintuitive, but there's data behind that claim. What's happening there is people who use needle exchange, people who visit a community center where they receive a crack pipe, what they're doing is engaging with the system. They're engaging with the healthcare system, or they're engaging with community support. And for a lot of people, that is a gateway to treatment. If that's what you want to do, it sounds counterintuitive, but what something like distributing crack pipes can do is actually encourage treatment.
Yeah, because you are then also treating this as a health issue for yourself and not self-medicating. You're going to a facility that can help you with your health issue. And then that can, I guess, you say you're somebody that works at a needle exchange, that person can give you material. And I want to highlight some of the personal stories of the people on the front lines that you speak to in your book. But this just brings me to another question, because I know you wrote about this in your previous book, which I believe took place in Vancouver. Am I correct?
Yes, Vancouver, Canada.
Right. So a lot of this to me feels like there is a fear from the right wing in this country to, one, they don't want to think about addicts, and they assign a moral blame to addiction that is ridiculous. But two, that they are fearful of treating addiction as a health issue because it kind of cracks doors open about our healthcare system saving everybody and being available to everybody, even if you're houseless and you're addicted. Was there a difference in the approach to some of these programs in a country like Canada that does have universal health care as opposed to the United States, where there is not that literacy or that muscle memory?
Yeah, the story I tell in my first book, Fighting for Space, is Vancouver's history with harm reduction. A big piece of that story is the establishment of North America's first sanctioned supervised injection facility, InSite, which opened in 2003. But alongside that was the development of things like needle exchange and access to healthcare. And you're right, what all of that did is shift how we treat addiction from a criminal issue to a healthcare issue. And that had a big change, not just in terms of service provision, but service provision did change when we implemented harm reduction. As you mentioned, you know, in Canada, healthcare is public; it's supported by the government. And so, when we embraced harm reduction, we were able to do it, you know, in a larger way at a province or a state level. But beyond service provision, there was a big change in people's psyches, in their perceptions of addiction. You know, right now in North America, if you use drugs, you know, by definition, by legal definition, you are automatically a criminal. And if you're labeled a criminal, you know, that can make it really hard to ask for help. That can make it really hard to talk about the addiction that you're struggling with. And so when Canada began talking, and we still have a ways to go in this. I don't want to, you know, paint Canada as a field of flowers and meadows. But when we did begin to talk about addiction more as a healthcare issue, it opened doors for a lot of people. It said, okay, I'm not a criminal anymore, you know, even though we do still criminalize drugs. We're talking about this as a healthcare issue. I can ask for help.
So we've said this term many times already, and I know it's a focus a lot of your own research and your writing, but for our audience, do you mind defining harm reduction specifically in the context of drug use and addiction?
Yeah, I mean, something I like about harm reduction is it's right there in the title. I mean, you are reducing harm. That's the goal. Another defining characteristic is harm reduction is a response to drug use that does not necessarily require the end of that drug use. It says that we're going to improve your health regardless of whether or not you stop using drugs. It says, okay, you're going to use drugs, but rather than use a dirty needle you find on the street, let's give you a clean needle and prevent the spread of hepatitis C and HIV. And that's a reduction of harm. An easy analogy is seatbelts. You know, it wasn't that long ago. It was only, 50, 60 years ago when seatbelts were a lot less common. It was a lot less common to wear seatbelts in cars. And when we, you know, began education campaigns around seatbelts, we reduced the harm of driving. That's what's going on with harm reduction. You know, we're educating people about how these programs can improve people's health, whether or not that ends their drug use. It reduces harm.
I want to get to the personal stories that you tell in your book in a second, but you do touch on the drug war and the history here in the United States and how Richard Nixon, when he did start it, it was expressly to target domestic enemies and groups that he did not feel were supportive of the right wing, which was leftist anti-war activists and Black activists as well in the country. So when you talk about how the politics of harm reduction, or the policies, I should say, of harm reduction also just improve a drug user's health in general, prevents them from potentially dying, there's a part of me that thinks, honestly, the people that are most committed to criminalizing drug use, they're kind of okay with drug users dying.
Yeah, the war on drugs is this, you know, it's this really big thing in America now. It's this really big thing in Canada and the world, you know, where you've got DEA agents wearing bulletproof vests, you know, kicking in doors in every city across the country, and, you know, people looking over their shoulder when they use drugs, afraid of police, and, you know, a prison industrial complex that has just, you know, exploded over the last few decades. Of course, massively disproportionately locking up black and brown people. That's not the way it started. It started as a quiet thing with Richard Nixon, and it started ironically, you know, not being about drugs. Originally, the war on drugs was not about drugs. So I'll read you a quote I include in the book by John Ehrlichman. He was counsel and assistant to the president for domestic affairs in the administration of President Richard Nixon. So this is a guy who worked in the White House with Richard Nixon. And he said, the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about drugs? Of course we did. And that's the origin of the war on drugs under the Nixon administration. This was not about drugs. This was about locking up black and brown people. And I mean, mission accomplished.
Right. Exactly. And it seems like some of our, to be cynical about it, national consciousness about addiction did change when white people it was more out in the open that there was a problem of addiction among white populations in this country. But at the same time, it's also just like, you know, the positive part of me just says, well, people also realize this was BS from all of the years of the war on drugs failing. And there you tell the stories of two women in your book. We can get into that as well. Jess Tilley and Louise Vincent, two women who are on the front lines of this current iteration of specifically the opioid epidemic, but just the drug epidemic here in this country. Can you talk a little bit about their stories as well and what you found when talking to them about what they'd experienced?
Yeah, I mean, and these are two of the most amazing people I've ever met. Jess Tilley up in Massachusetts and Louise Vincent down in North Carolina. And like you said, you know, they're on the front lines of this crisis. They're doing harm reduction. They're doing needle exchange. They're doing overdose resuscitations and distributing the overdose reversal drug naloxone, Narcan. They're also using drugs, and they're also drug users. They're also organizing drug users to have a voice in our response to this crisis. This is a movement called drug user activism that kind of sits adjacent to harm reduction, or really at the birth of harm reduction, where drug users are taking their lives into their own hands, saying, you know, this overdose crisis affects us, and we want a seat at the table. And I mean, of course, that would be a given, a no-brainer in any other crisis. Let's, you know, sit down with the people affected. But that's not what has happened in response to the overdose crisis. And so what Louise and Jess are doing in addition to their harm reduction work is organizing people who use drugs across the country, holding monthly and weekly meetings on Zoom and in the real world when they can, saying, you know, we know this crisis better than anybody. You know, we're the people who are dying, and we know what would solve it. Things like supervised injection facilities, things like fentanyl test strips, and above all, decriminalization and an end to the war on drugs. And they're saying, we want to fight for those policies in Washington, D.C. We want people who use drugs to have a seat at this table.
And the reason that you don't feel that they have been provided seats at the table, you know, or what are those reasons would you attribute it to? Would it just be the fact that, again, people don't want to see or hear about drug users? They want to implement policies on them and then go away? Or is it... is it something different than that?
No, I mean, this is stigma. I mean, this is, I mean, it's discrimination. It's discrimination on the basis of a healthcare issue, if that's what you believe addiction is. And with any other crisis, this would be a given. You would sit down with the people affected. But as we discussed earlier, you know, by legal definition, if you use drugs in this country, you are a criminal. And, you know, so what sitting down with people who use drugs to talk about this crisis would mean is inviting criminals to the White House. And so it's that decriminalization piece that really has to change, you know, if we're going to get serious about tackling addiction, if we're going to give a voice to those who are worst affected by this crisis, if we're going to bring people who use drugs out of the shadows and allow them to speak openly and ask for help, we need to end the war on drugs and we need to end criminalization.
Right. And so I guess let's talk a little bit more about these women's stories as well, because obviously both are filled with significant trauma, and that is often at the heart of many of these stories. talk a little bit about what you found, and I guess how you can extrapolate that, and how it's a through line, basically.
It's a really important part of the book. You know, the book does not begin with Louise and Jess fighting back against the war on drugs and organizing people who use drugs. It begins in their childhood and their teenage years, really, to establish how addiction works. You know, Jess Tilley was someone who was sexually abused when she was young and then again through her teenage years. And Louise Vincent is someone who has struggled with mental health issues. She speaks openly about the struggle she's had with bipolar disorder. And I talk about those traumas in the book because I want to establish that, you know, these are not people who are using drugs for fun. And this is true for, I would argue, of a large majority of people who use hard drugs in the country. If you're using heroin, you're not partying on weekends. Odds are, you know, overwhelmingly, that you're self-medicating for something that's something terrible that's happened in your past. I began to realize this in 2008 or 2009 when a favorite author of mine, Dr. Gabor Mate, came out with a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And he at length discusses how people who use drugs are responding to trauma and self-medicating because, you know, our mental health care system is not a big help, especially if you struggle with an addiction. And what's so important about realizing that people who use drugs are self-medicating, are just, you know, struggling to deal with things that happened in their past, is by you realize that with criminalization, you're victimizing a victim. You know, you're taking someone who suffered some sort of abuse, for example, in their past, and instead of offering them help, you're throwing them in prison. You're punishing someone who has already dealt with something terrible. And I think when people begin to realize that, they'll begin to understand, you know, just how unfair, just how awful that is. And that can begin to change attitudes on the war on drugs. So mental health and trauma are a really big piece of this entire overdose crisis. We're not dealing with trauma, past trauma, or mental health. People are self-medicating. And in this overdose crisis, they're dying. And our response is to throw them in jail.
And even current trauma, I mean, specifically in the United States, our systems of, I mean, we have zero safety net, basically. It's incredibly precarious. And if you even fall or slip or have some sort of incident that is beyond your control, it's very easy to be in a constant state of anxiety because there's really nothing to help you.
Yeah, this is a mental health care crisis. You know, its roots are, its roots predate, you know, OxyContin and Purdue Pharma and the overprescription of drugs that you know, are so often blamed for this crisis. It's much deeper than that. It's inequality. It's a lack of safety nets. It's, you know, the failures of the mental health care system. It's mental health care issues and past and present trauma and all those things that we're not dealing with. People are hurting in this country and we don't have systems to help them. And instead they're finding opiates. Originally, you know, in the early 2000s, that was prescription pills like OxyContin. Once doctors realized their mistakes and began clamping down on prescriptions, people didn't just stop using drugs. They were addicted. So they transitioned to heroin, moving to the streets. And then dealers found out they could make a lot more money off much more dangerous synthetic opiate called fentanyl. So we're in our third wave now from prescription pills to heroin to fentanyl. But the root cause of this crisis is mental health care issues, inequality, and a lack of social support. That's the problem that's killing 100,000 people a year.
And the criminalization also leads to some of these like black market up and down quality of the product pitfalls and dangers. I mean, I hadn't even heard of carfentanil. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because is that the fourth wave of what we're seeing coming up?
Oh God, I hope not. Carfentanil, if morphine sits here and heroin sits here and fentanyl sits here, you know, carfentanil is a couple feet up off the screen. This is a really dangerous synthetic drug that's legally used to tranquilize animals like elephants and rhinoceroses. I mean, this is not a recreational substance. Jeez. And it's being mixed in to our narcotic supply. And the reason is the war on drugs. Our response to this overdose crisis has been the war on drugs. You know, let's throw people in jail. But that has unintended consequences. This is something called the Iron Law of Prohibition. You know, this is an established concept. It has a Wikipedia page, and it says when you try and clamp down on illegal narcotics, and when you arrest people for using them and dealers for selling them, you don't actually reduce the supply of that drug. Instead, you incentivize people who sell drugs to come up with a more potent formulation, something that is easier to transport, takes up less space. With fentanyl, it's a lot easier to produce than heroin. And so we've seen this transition from heroin to fentanyl. And now in some areas, carfentanil is not especially common yet, but in some areas, carfentanil. And that's the Iron Law of Prohibition. You know, dealers are looking at heroin and they're saying, this stuff is kind of hard to make. This stuff is kind of hard to transport. You know, I got to find land for a poppy field. I got to pay workers to, you know, to grow those poppies. I got to pay to harvest. I have to pay chemists to turn the opium into heroin. And then I got to transport these bulky packages across the border. The war on drugs incentivizes them to stop all of that and move to fentanyl. Here, you know, you can cook a small amount of this substance in a basement laboratory, move it in envelopes as opposed to, you know, crates, and sell it for a much higher profit margin. Our response has been the war on drugs, and that has only made this crisis more deadly.
And so carfentanil is even a smaller, smaller, I guess, surface area, or
it's more potent, so it takes up less space, and that's incentivized by the war on drugs.
And is it like fentanyl able to be created in a basement laboratory in the same way?
Yeah, it's very similar. I mean, it's a chemical cousin. So these are drugs that are cooked in laboratories and in incredibly small amounts. They will get you high. But because those amounts are so tiny, it makes, you know, mixing and distribution very difficult to get precise. A favorite analogy is chocolate chip cookies. You know, you never know how many chocolate chips you're going to get in one cookie. And that's what's happening with fentanyl and carfentanil. And if you get too many chocolate chips, you die.
Yeah, that and there's no way really of telling, right? I mean, in terms of other harm reduction policies that could potentially help, if we were to build and create more safe injection sites around the country, that would also allow for more distribution of Narcan, as well as, I mean, test strips. That also could help, right? In terms of weeding out some of the more potent, like, say, fentanyls in your cocaine or in your heroin.
Yeah, fentanyl test strips are being distributed in more and more areas around the country and in Canada as well. And they work. You know, they tell you whether or not your substance has fentanyl, but they're hitting their effectiveness is hitting a wall here. In some areas like Vancouver, Canada, like Philadelphia, you've all but seen fentanyl entirely replace heroin. And so if you're addicted to opiates and heroin is no longer available, fentanyl is really your only option to stave off withdrawal. And so you can use a fentanyl test strip and you can know that the substance that you're about to inject has fentanyl in it, but you can't do anything about it. Mm. You know, you're physically dependent and mentally addicted, and you're going to use this substance, and you know it's going to be dangerous. You don't know, you know, and you don't even know what you're putting in your body. You don't know how much fentanyl is in there. You don't know what else is cut in there. That's another reason that ending the war on drugs is so important, for simple autonomy, so that people who use drugs can understand and know what they put in their own bodies. And that's not the case right now. You're addicted, but you don't know what you're putting in your body. Injection sites would go further. You know, they create a safe environment where people can bring drugs, and instead of using them in an alley with a dirty needle with, you know, a man leering over their shoulder, you're in a safe environment where a program worker has greeted you with a smile and giving you a clean needle and giving you space and time to inject. And, you know, instead of a dealer looking over your shoulder, there's a nurse who's there to respond with Narcan in case you overdose. Supervised injection sites work. You know, Vancouver has had one running since 2003. Europe has had injection sites running for decades. There's now dozens more across Canada established since 2016. And at all these facilities, the number of deaths that has occurred is zero. No one has ever died at an injection site. They work. But America has been very reluctant to allow injection sites to open.
We're later on in this program likely going to talk about subsidized housing. There are a lot of people in this country that say, not in my neighborhood, as if that would change the number of addicts who are in the neighborhood, really. Or, I mean, and not that it would even matter. Not that he would. There needs to be broader compassion for this, which I think is why the work you're doing and the work of the people on the front lines is so important, because it reframes it in the exact way that you've described.
I mean, there's actually a lot of evidence that shows that supportive housing reduces drug use. And I've seen this with my own eyes in my work as a journalist, meeting with people over a number of years who lived on the street and then moved into supportive housing. When you move someone off the street and into housing, you reduce a significant amount of stress. You know, just imagine the stress that comes with homelessness, not knowing where you're going to shower, where you're going to change clothes for a job interview, where you're going to keep those clothes clean, where you're going to sleep. Is it going to be safe? Where your next meal is coming from? Homelessness is just constant anxiety and stress. And when you give someone supportive housing, you remove a significant amount of that stress. And that removes a significant incentive to use drugs. You know, you've cut out all that stress out of their life, so they have less of a reason to use drugs. Supportive housing is a great way to respond to addiction.
What are some of your, what's some advice that you would give to policymakers, lawmakers in this country of how to approach this? The Biden administration seems to have taken a step forward a bit with this grant program, but there's obviously a lot more that can be done.
Yeah, let's begin by acknowledging people's concerns. Needle exchange, supervised injection, especially decriminalization. You know, these are concepts that can sound scary to people. And let's acknowledge that. And let's say we understand and let's talk about it. And then let's move on to education. I mentioned earlier, you know, that harm reduction is something with a small mountain of data behind it. Let's begin looking at that data, sharing it, explaining to people, you know, this actually, you might think so, but this actually doesn't increase drug use. What it does is reduce the spread of infectious disease, and that's good for everybody. When Vancouver opened North America's first injection site, InSight, in 2003, that was the end. Oh, that wasn't the end, but that was, you know, a milestone in a long battle in more than a decade of concerted activism, of marching in the streets, of occupying city council meetings, but more than anything, of education. You know, that has to be the biggest piece of all of this. Helping people understand that these concepts, these programs, don't encourage drug use. They simply let people live healthier lives. So my advice would be education.
Well, Travis Lupik, author of Light Up the Night, America's Overdose Crisis and the Drug Users Fighting for Survival. Travis, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, talk a little bit more, and then we will be joined by Jessica Cisneros, running for Congress in Texas's 28th district. Be right back. We are back. So we just spent the last 30, 40 minutes talking to Travis Lupik about harm reduction and drug addiction programs in this country. The Biden administration did a good thing with this grant program, which is funding harm reduction throughout the country. It's not that much money, but it is a way to allow for programs like ones we've seen in Philadelphia, New York, and other cities around the country, safe injection sites, for example, which drastically reduce deaths, You have a nurse who can prevent someone from overdosing, provide them with clean needles, prevent the spread of HIV, as well as other drug paraphernalia, the handing out of cleaner drug paraphernalia so people aren't sharing and risking contracting diseases. Because the right wing can't admit that they actually want basically drug addicts to die and get diseases and don't necessarily want to think about them or care about them and see disease resulting from drug abuse as just kind of the price of doing business. They can't say that.
They feel served by the brutal aspects of the drug war.
Yes. And all, right, exactly. They can't say that, but they can make racist comments about crack pipes that are very thinly veiled, just that are, throwing it back.
Sorry to interrupt, but like the problem with this is like the way this is done, like as if Candace Owens was actually standing up for black people. Tucker and Candace come into the like that it was Joe Biden who is being racist. Like it's really despicable stuff.
Yep. And here is Jen Psaki responding to a question about this program at the White House press briefing.
Thanks, Jen. HHS just put out a statement clarifying around some reports that crack pipes would be part of the safe smoking kits that are funded by the administration. But can you clarify for us, were they never a part of the kit, or were they removed in response to this reporting and this pushback?
They were never a part of the kit. It was inaccurate reporting, and we wanted to put out information to make that clear.
What is in the safe smoking kit?
A safe smoking skin may contain alcohol swabs, lip balm, other materials to promote hygiene and reduce the transmission of diseases like HIV and hepatitis. I would note that what we're really talking about here is steps that we're taking as a federal government to address the opioid epidemic, which is killing tens of thousands, if not more, Americans every single day, week, month of the year. We put out this statement, though, because there was inaccurate information out there, or I should say HHS put out this statement because there was inaccurate information out there, and we wanted to provide clarification on the allowable uses for the HHS harm reduction program. It's not a change in policy. This program, though, is focused on harm reduction strategies, including prioritizing the use of fentanyl test strips and clean syringes, and all of these harm reduction services that will be supported by these programs are intended to save lives from an epidemic that we know is devastating to communities across the country.
So notice that she conceded the syringe point, but not the crack pipe point. Why?
Like, and that's such the problem with this statement from HHS. Like, the program is meant to, quote, support community-based overdose prevention programs, syringe service programs, and other harm reduction service programs. That includes the pipes. Safe pipes are the same thing as safe syringes, just because you have different sort of connotations in your head because they're primed by American culture and the right wing particularly. This is a health fact. This is just health.
And I mean... correct me if I'm wrong, but they're just like not calling them crack pipes in the safe smoking kits.
Well, I'm not sure what the actual thing is. They're saying it's not going to be used for any sort of like Becerra said that, like it wasn't for any sort of pipes or any reimbursements later down the line. So like I don't know if this is like the Hyde Amendment stuff, right? Where like we have to be super strict about what's going where, when it should be up to the medical and health providers.
Like, exactly.
This is simple stuff.
Right. I mean, it's better than it's just so silly because the way that you're going to ingest the drug, it's going to be ingested either way. You can provide a clean way for that to happen. Like, handing out straws and $1 bills on Wall Street is the equivalent of what's being done here. Let's be real about what kind of drugs are being taken there.
Well, and I really think the what's transformational about them and what is why Marco Rubio and Candace Owens and all these people are threatened by this is the on-ramp to public health.
Yep.
Because, like, that whole thing where the system is, instead of treating you like a criminal that they're hunting down, is actually providing for you and caring for your safety. And, by the way, if you're done getting the hit and want to come get clean through these services, like, that's what we should be doing.
Here's somebody you trust. Here's a health provider that has not judged you, that has looked out for you, provide you with clean needles or pipes, and then that allows for you them to come to that person and say, hey, I may need help. I may need to get off this. That's exactly the point. The right wing is terrified. One, they see this as a great opportunity to hit Biden, who, by the way, I don't know, I'm old enough to remember the 2020 primary when he was being hit over and over again because of the draconian crime bill that Biden pushed forward. Yep. He has been instrumental in the locking up of addicts and the criminalization of drug addiction. So this is like, talk about harm reduction. This is one of the least that Biden can do in order to reduce the own harm that he's caused.
No, he has a history of caving to this sort of pressure, or like even worse, like joining the chorus with it.
Right.
And it was always, of course, the problem with Biden. It was he never promised to like legalize marijuana in the primary. He's always said like, I've got to look at that. Right. Like even though it's the most blatant things. It reminded me of Acorn a lot in the folding of the Democrats when they need to grow a backbone and actually stand up for like what's right, and instead they just grant all of the framing of the right and retreat. And it's like the you look into these kits, and whether it's in San Francisco or the other cases, like they include the pipes. Right. So if you're supporting those programs, you need to be supporting
the science.
Pipes. Exactly. Like we said, like
harm reduction.
Harm reduction doesn't care about your feelings.
Right. Like you said. Right. Yeah. Matt's quoting himself. But it's a great point. And why they are afraid, the right wing is, yes, they want to continue to use the racist tropes, and just the second part of, and building off of what you said about public health.
I mean, that's what originally happened with, like, expanding healthcare in the middle of the 20th century, was, like, you used racism in the South to say, like, oh, yeah, we're not going to let the government take over healthcare and integrate us.
But this goes hand in hand with, and it seems like a loose connection, but bear with me, with someone like Nancy Pelosi's insistence that we are not going to temporarily expand Medicare during the pandemic.
Oh, yeah. It's the same thing.
We're going to do COBRA subsidies.
Honestly, do you really think if, like, let's say you're a Pelosi donor and it's just you and her in a room and you'd be like, these crack pipes? And she's like, yeah, I don't know what's going on with that. We got to look into that. Like, I don't think she would stand up for that stuff.
Of course not. Of course not. They're not going to stand up for the most vulnerable in our society when they feel that it hurts them.
If they can do it with some cover, yeah, they might give you some scraps.
Maybe if the CIA, when they were helping fund the crack sale during the 80s, maybe if they handed out crack pipes, that might have been some way that you can get the Republicans on board with it. Right? No? Silly. All right. All right. We're still waiting on Jessica Cisneros, I believe. We might just have to take a quick break before she joins us. But we're going to do that. Sorry about that, guys. We will be back when Jessica Cisneros is with us shortly. We are back, and we are joined by Jessica Cisneros, who is running against Henry Cuellar in Texas's 28th district. Jessica, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Happy to be here.
Of course, it's good to see you and good to talk to you again, because we did speak when you ran last time, but there have been some developments in the life of Henry Cuellar in particular, and also in your race. So talk a little bit about what's going on with the FBI raid into your opponent's home. Seems like a gift for anyone running against that kind of person.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, especially with all the work that we've been doing since the last election cycle, for those of y'all who might have watched closely or, you know, need a little update on what happened with our race last time when we ran against Cuellar, we were able to earn 48.2% of the vote in our first run. So, you know, we came a little bit short. It was just 2,700 votes. One of the fantastic things about the work that we were doing and setting up the political infrastructure here in South Texas for a race like ours was that that infrastructure was still there when we decided to run again, right? So we're continuing to build on what we created last cycle, all the folks who were plugged into our campaign, people who remember, you know, who I am from the last run, because name ID was such a huge hurdle as a first time candidate. And our district is huge, almost as big as the state of New Jersey. So a lot of ground to cover. And then for Henry Cuellar, you know, 5 weeks out from the election to get raided by the FBI, both his home and his campaign headquarters, I think it forced a lot of people, one, to pay attention to the race a little bit earlier than most folks do. My experience from last time around was that people didn't really make a decision until a week before voting started. And this time around, we saw that as the FBI raid happened a few days later, like, people were really paying attention to our race and saying that they were absolutely committed to supporting our campaign, which was fantastic. But two, I mean, it just, the fact that he got raided by the FBI and that the task force that was involved in the raid is one that investigates bribery and corruption just kind of tracks with what we've been, you know, kind of screaming since day one, right? That this really is a symptom of Henry Cuellar's track record, right? We've been talking about the corruption in terms of where he's getting his, you know, cash for his campaign committee. A lot of these corporate PACs, such as the Koch Industries and the Chamber of Commerce and the American Petroleum Institute, all these Republican special interest and corporate donors spending, you know, money to try to influence how he votes and throw our community under the bus in our process. But all of a sudden, you know, it lends even more, I guess, urgency as to why we need to replace him, because he's obviously not seeking our best interests as a community here in Texas 28.
Yeah, and I want to get to his record in a little bit, but you made such an important point that I want to touch on, which is the fact that you ran an aggressive, progressive campaign, grassroots funded, you're just with the Justice Democrats as well, and you set up an infrastructure there that is so important. I mean, we saw Stacey Abrams do this in Georgia, right, where she ran for the governor's race, and it set up an infrastructure there that allowed for there to be these two senators that were elected in Georgia. And then you saw the flip side of this in Kentucky, where Amy McGrath got a bunch of money poured into her race, and Charles Booker, who had a more grassroots campaign, he was able to clearly build a ton of momentum at the end. And you saw what could have happened if that kind of campaign was able to be funded. It would have set up an infrastructure in Kentucky for more progressive candidates down the line. So I know you touched on this a bit, but are you seeing the fact that you have all you've done this before pay dividends this time around?
Absolutely. And as much as Henry Cuellar tries to pay for momentum, I mean, it's not something that can get bought, right? Like, that really is something provided by people. And I think that's part of what we're trying to show people. Like, he might have $2 million in the bank, but we have people behind our campaign. So we don't have to outraise them. We don't have to outspend them. We just need to be able to have the resources to be able to compete, because the reality is, and something that we saw last cycle, was that as soon as we introduce our campaign to voters, they know who I am, they know what I stand for, they know the policies that I support and how that's different from Cuellar, they vote for us. But, you know, it does take resources to put our campaign in front of voters. People who don't know who you are likely not going to vote for you. So for us, I mean, we know the responsibility and the trust that people are placing in our campaign at the moment that they donate either their time and money. And we just want to be strategic about how we're spending those resources, because we know they're really precious, but they're really important in making sure that grassroots campaigns like ours are successful.
Really important, because your district is, or your potential district is, a safe blue district. And it has just gotten bluer over in between your last run. And it is represented by one of the most conservative Democrats in Congress. And obviously, there have been issues. There are issues with corruption. Let's be real here. But some of the positions that he takes are just so incompatible with the blueness of the district. For example, he is a anti-choice Democrat, especially with all of the news that has come out of Texas and the fact that the state legislature there has essentially set up a bounty system for people who are trying to get an abortion. Talk a little bit about the contrast between you, yourself and your opponent on that key issue that's facing Texans right now.
Yes. And I will say, before I dive into that, one of the, in addition to Henry Cuellar trying to say that, you know, that there's a myth that South Texas is really conservative and that he votes, you know, the way that the district wants him to vote, which is absolutely false, because I think we proved that last time. Because if that was true, 48% of the people wouldn't have trusted a 26-year-old first-time challenger with their vote if they really felt that, you know, the congressman was doing a good job in representing our values here in South Texas. But after the FBI raid, I mean, that also, our district is safely blue, and that is true. And Cuellar is trying to, you know, make this electability argument, right? But after an FBI raid, I mean, who really is the most electable candidate, right? Like, that just turns his electability argument on its head, because it's like, if Henry Cuellar makes it to the general election, there is a very, very real possibility that people are not going to be okay with that. And they don't want someone who's under investigation by the FBI, potentially for bribery and corruption charges, to be the nominee, right? It might potentially flip the district red. And we don't want that. This is a safe blue seat. We want to make sure we're putting forth our best nominee, which is our campaign. And we've been saying that from the very beginning. But in terms of our values, I mean, that's just another reason why people should really vote and trust this campaign, that we're going to do our best to champion the values and interests of people here. Because as I mentioned, if I ran an unabashedly pro-choice campaign, I did that from the moment that I ran in 2019, because those are my values. And it was so validating, again, to see that people voted for our campaign. And if Cuellar really was representing the values of our district, if our district was anti-choice the way that he says it is, there's no reason why we were so close to defeating him last time. So I think for us, especially after what happened with the Senate Bill 8 that came out of the Texas legislature, it was so infuriating for many folks here in the district, because he was the only Democrat to vote against the Women's Health Protection Act, which came to a vote on the House floor as a response to this Texas bill, this abortion ban. And for him to say, well, I'm voting my conscience because I don't think this is healthcare. I mean, who is he to say what is our healthcare and what isn't, right? He's not a doctor and he's a man. He was never going to be, you know, in a position to have to choose what if he were to need abortion healthcare. So it really got a lot of people really angry. We actually had our first phone bank a few days after that. And the first voter that I spoke to was a woman who was really upset that Henry Cuellar was the only Democrat to vote against the Women's Health Protection Act. So people have really been paying attention to what he's been doing in Congress, which is great. And I think a development from last cycle, where we had to do a lot of the teaching of, like, this is what he's been doing in Congress. This time around, people are keeping a close eye.
Yeah. So what does he consider healthcare? Because he certainly doesn't consider healthcare to be a right in the form of Medicare for all. Talk a little bit about the contrast between yourself and Cuellar on healthcare in general.
Yeah. I mean, for us, a big reason why I decided to run is because I believe in Medicare for all, because there's so many people here in this district who have lost loved ones because we cannot afford their care. we actually went up with our first ad this cycle, and it was a healthcare ad. And it was talking about my personal story, my why of why I think healthcare should be a human right and not a privilege. And it was about, you know, 13-year-old me having to fundraise for my tia for my aunt's cancer treatment. Like, there's no world in which we should, you know, a 13-year-old, a teenager should have to like try to worry about how to find money to pay for her relative's healthcare. And unfortunately, that is the story of so many South Texans, where it's up to us to try to scramble and try to come up with the money to be able to care for our loved ones. And it shouldn't be that way. I mean, it's a policy choice. We know that. And unfortunately, there's people like Wead who are subject to the whim of the health insurance industry, which, you know, gives money in exchange for their votes. So that's one of the very clear contrasts between who he's working for and who we are actually championing for in terms of our stances.
I want to ask you a little bit about housing in your district, because, and correct me if I'm wrong, your district is narrow and it includes suburbs of San Antonio and Laredo as well. I would imagine that in the face of the pandemic, you've received a lot of questions from people in that district about affordable housing. What is your stance on those issues? We're seeing, you know, there's a big piece in ProPublica the other day about how much private equity is buying up these housing developments, pushing up costs and also cutting on investment in those facilities in and of themselves. What's your position on affordable housing in general?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think now that we have a bigger part of San Antonio in our district after redistricting, that is an issue that's going to keep coming up a lot. And I have noticed, for example, my hometown of Laredo, which is where I live, we are basically on track to become San Antonio, and San Antonio's on track to become Austin. I'm sure y'all have heard of like the nightmares of trying to afford rent in Austin. And for me, it's imperative to find out what the solution is, because I don't want Laredo heading that way. I don't want San Antonio heading that way. I know it's a really big crisis right now in Austin. So we need to figure out what we can do in terms of housing affordability, whether that is investment in, you know, creating housing developments that have affordable units, whether that is allotting, you know, working with the municipalities to try to allot money to be able to create affordable housing. We need to figure out what that is, because there's so many folks that already, like you mentioned, after the pandemic aren't able to meet rent. And I mean, it's just becoming a huge issue. And I've noticed it much more during the pandemic here in Laredo, because our poverty rate in my hometown, it's been at a steady 30% for the past, you know, couple of decades. And what folks here usually have to work two or three jobs just to make ends meet. And then during the pandemic, there were a lot of people that were laid off. So like, if you get fired or laid off from one of those jobs, that really affects whether you're going to be able to pay your mortgage or your bills at the end of the month, or rent if you are renting. So I think here, absolutely, one of the things that we have to do is advocate to increase the minimum wage so that folks are going to be able to have a little bit more money in their pockets to be able to pay for their expenses. But then we also have to look at the what else can we do in terms of housing so that we can create a lot of those affordable units, because it's we're not heading in a good direction right now.
I also wanted to ask you a little bit more about your opponent and the fact that he seems to have, well, it's his grip is loosening, but I wasn't even fully aware of how dynastic his entire family is and how involved they are in the political machine down there. Have you run up against some of those issues, because so many of the Cuellar family tentacles are all over the local politics there, because his wife's also involved as well in the political system? What are some of the issues structurally that you've had with the fact that his family is, you know, they're kind of, they've taken hold a little bit in that area?
Yeah, I mean, Henry Cuellar, for those who might not be familiar with his political career, he's been representing my hometown of Laredo longer than I've been alive. So he started in the Texas House, then was Secretary of State under Rick Perry, and then ran for House in Congress. And so literally it's been like almost three decades of him being in a position that affects Laredo. And for us, I mean, that was part of, I guess, the obstacles that we had to overcome the first time around, because there were a lot of people that were supportive, but they kind of had to be quiet about it, because they were afraid, that they, you know, of if they show support for our campaign. So there was like a chilling effect, right? The fact that he and his family have been, in one capacity or the other governing over Laredo. But we've noticed that after we were able to put up 48.2% of the vote in our last race, it's given the confidence for so many people to say we deserve more. Because there were a lot of folks who were supportive, but weren't sure if we were going to be able to pull it off. And I think after our great run last time, people are like, she just needed a little bit more. And I'm brave enough this time to stand with her and say that we do deserve more. So that's definitely been something that's been helping with momentum this time around, because people before this, I think, thought that he was untouchable, and we showed that he was vulnerable. And I think on March 1st, we're going to show that he was definitely someone that we can defeat.
March 1st. That is the day of your primary. Where can people donate, support in any way that they possibly can? Canvas, phone bank for you. What's the best way to help out right now?
Absolutely. Right now, if you're near Texas 28th, San Antonio, Laredo, down in the Rio Grande Valley, rural areas of our district, we need people to knock on doors. So if you're able to do that, please plug into our campaign. And if you aren't, please chip in whatever you can. It really goes a long way. We're able to nickel and dime our way to having a pretty successful race last time around, and we're planning on doing the same thing. So you can go visit jessicacisneros.com. My last name is C-I-S. It's like back here. C-I-S-N-E-R-O-S.com. And yes, we'd appreciate all the help we can get. We are 4 days out from the start of our election. Monday's the first day people can go to the polls and vote. So we're really trying to push people all weekend to let them know they can start voting on Monday. So any help you can give us, it would really go a long way this weekend.
Okay, incredible. Jessica Cisneros running in Texas's 28th district. I mean, I'm open. I hope you win. rooting for you, and best of luck in the primary, because that likely is the determinative factor for the election. So big days ahead.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jessica. All right, with that, a little bit of a longer show, but wanted to be able to talk to Jessica.
Should we get Brandon and Matt in here just to do a quick plug, and then we'll have a short segment
sure
between then, so we can go to the fun half, and then we'll come back, that maybe Binder and Brandon can duck off there, but I'll let Brandon in now. And as I do that, I'll just plug Left Reckoning.
Yes, Left Reckoning happened last night, Matt.
So we had a really, really great show. We started off with David Griscom giving people an overview on the concept of false consciousness and its sort of overuse on the left, saying people don't know what their own material interests are, and there's a lot of people stopping there and not really doing the work of what leads people to come down in certain ways. And then we had Mike Preisner on of the Empire Files talking about Ukraine. He's very dismissive of the idea that Russia is actually going to invade and thinks that basically America needs to just cool it. And we also talked about Afghanistan, and we played that atrocious Rand Paul clip about that to show kind of what libertarians give you. But the interesting thing was to talk about the different splits in the anti-war movement, which is you get anti-imperialist and you get liberal. And he mentioned in the Gulf War that basically went where everyone was saying no war with Iraq to the liberal group, which was much bigger, saying sanctions, not war. And those sanctions end up being extremely brutal killed a bunch of people and genocidal. So that, and then we also had Andrew Hairston, who's running for Justice of the Peace in Austin. And he has Justice of the Peace. It sounds like an old fashioned style office, but you'll want to see this interview because dealing with things like evictions and stuff, to have a genuine socialist and prison abolitionist on. Really great interview. So very fun show last night. Check that out, folks.
It sounds really good. I will be checking that out. We do not have now. Do we have Brandon?
You do. You have me, but and here I am.
Oh, there Hello. You go. Camera's working.
I didn't even realize that I was still in the meeting.
Well, I mean, now you're on air, so don't fuck up.
I'll do my best. You know, I haven't not fucked up so far. Wait, what? That might be a double negative, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Well, what's happening over on the discourse? Let's transition into that.
Well, you know, we'll have a new episode up for you by the end of the week. What is in that episode always remains to be seen. But, you know, I imagine we'll be just discussing the end of COVID pandemic precautions and all of those other wonderful things.
Okay, wonderful.
And here is Matt Binder.
There he is. Perfect timing.
Binder had Sam Cedar on the show on Wednesday evening. I'm sure he'll be plugging that unless he's... anxious to move on because Sam disgraced the show. But Binder, are you there?
He's coming.
I'm here. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
How are you?
Doing well. How was hanging out with Sam?
Oh, it was great. We had a long discussion about, you know, cancel culture and Joe Rogan. And why the right wing personalities online love to fool their fans into making them believe they're actually listening to old school real liberals or centrists. It was a great conversation. That happened Tuesday night on Doomed. You can check it out on YouTube at youtube.com/Matt Binder or at doomedcast.com, where all the podcast links are. And then tonight will be an episode of Scam Economy on YouTube live at 9 p.m. We'll be talking about the Bitfinex hack and the two wonderful people who very interesting people who were arrested and charged with not the hack, but the laundering of the money taken from the hack. So we'll get into that. And also, I was on Busy Phillips's podcast talking about crypto and NFT. Yeah. So, she's a celebrity who, was wondering why all these celebrities were pushing this stuff. And she reached out to me and, we had a long conversation.
She's not CAA then.
I don't know because she is on a current show. Like she is on a show on,
She's like been in the like kind of progressive activist sphere a little bit, right?
Yes, she was. She said she thought something was screwy when she saw the Jimmy Fallon Paris Hilton interview.
Got a good head on shoulders.
Yeah, and then after talking with her, I'm pretty sure if you listen to it, you'll come away with her being strongly in the anti crypto NFT camp.
Incredible. All right. Well, I'm going to check that out, too. All right. We are going to then head into the fun half. We'll be taking your calls, reading your IMs, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back. Bye.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
see white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflakes says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Blast. Come on. Blast. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
Pussy, 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 pussy.